Are you ready? To bring that paper cup?
Okay, we'll call to order the House Committee on Judiciary, Civil Law. Welcome, everybody. I want to take things a little bit out of order here. Start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 20. We have enough members to do that. Also, so everyone knows, we will be taking testimony today on Senate Bill 20. We will not be, and it's not my intention to move the bill today. Also on House Bill 2633, we have some specific testimony I want to get, and we will not be moving that bill today. So, with that said, let's start with a public hearing on Senate Bill 20. And as soon as I see the witness sheet, thank you. Yeah, Brad Swink, come on up. While he's coming, counsel, if you'd give us the overview.
Yes, Senate Bill 20 designates as violations all offenses that do not provide for a term of imprisonment. It consolidates all the substantive and procedural provisions into a single ORS chapter and establishes uniform categories and fine amounts, as well as prescribing citation forms issued for all violations, and creates a single set of procedures for adjudication of these offenses.
Okay, Mr. Swank, welcome.
Thank you.
That's my line.
Chair Chatterley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. I'm here to give you some background about Senate Bill 20, why it's here, how it got here, what it does, what it does not do, and to answer some questions about it if you have some. Why is it here? In the early 70s, Oregon did a study on traffic and created a new level of offense. It was called infractions, and they were for traffic. And it left it. Traffic infractions are a non-criminal offense, I guess, if you can say that. Basically, there is less process due. They can be processed more quickly. The basis for starting them is by issuing a citation by an officer, and that goes to court. And at that time, somebody could basically post their bail and not show up for those kinds of offenses, and you'd forfeit the bail and never hear from them again. It was a popular way to handle minor offenses that were punishable by just a fine, and in the late 70s and early 80s, a number of other kinds of offenses, fish and wildlife, aeronautics, school attendance, and a group of others were all created, modeled after the traffic. And what happened was that this created a number of different series in the ORS, all of which had their own processes, all of which operated similarly, but not exactly the same, because sometimes the traffic statutes, for instance, would get amended and the others wouldn't. So you had about a total of seven different types of series for these non-criminal offenses and how you issue tickets and what's supposed to be on the tickets and how they go about getting it in court. And the law improvement, the Oregon Law Commission, I correct myself, during the last interim said this looks like an area where the law could be improved by standardizing the procedures and making all of these processes for violations and infractions for all of these non-criminal offenses the same process, and be a good way to simplify it. So the Oregon Law Improvement Commission started looking at it, and about the same time the Chief Justice's Criminal Law Advisory Committee started looking at it, the same issue for other reasons. And the Law Improvement, the Oregon Law Commission decided to take on the project of revising these statutes to create a single process for these non-criminal offenses. And since the Chief Justice's Criminal Law Advisory Commission had already started looking at it, they said, well, look at it, bring it to us, let us know what you think should happen. The Criminal Law Advisory Committee started a work group that involved members of the Oregon Law Commission. It involved members from the Criminal Law Advisory Committee to the extent possible that we could get officers to come in. We brought officers in. We got a state policeman. We got some municipal court justices, some municipal court judges, some justices of the peace justices. We got a district court judge at that time, because there was still district court at that time, and we brought David Hendricks in from Legislative Counsel's office, and we sat down to work over these groups of statutes to create a single process in the statute for these kinds of non-criminal offenses. And The work group put out a product and sent it out for comment. It went to the Criminal Law Advisory Committee of the Chief Justice, who made some adjustments, sent it to the Oregon Law Commission, and they had the bill introduced. The bill went to the Senate, where there were a number of comments and some amendments, mostly technical things and what I would call comfort amendments on the part of local government to make sure that it didn't affect things that we weren't sure it was going to affect anyway, but we put language in the bill to make it clear that it didn't affect, in a number of instances, how they enforced their local ordinances that they created. So what the bill primarily does is to standardize the procedure that goes with an officer issuing a ticket where the only penalty you're going to get is a fine. And we all know that from the beginning. And it folds all of these different kinds of offenses into this one process. So there will be just one process for that. It does some other things that the work group and the State Criminal Law Advisory Committee and the Oregon Law Commission thought were good. It allows DAs, it gives district attorneys an option currently. Because we're dealing with infractions, we also had to deal to some extent with misdemeanors. And under current law, if you cite for a misdemeanor, and in other than traffic situations, the citation goes to the court, and it's not a charging instrument, which means that a district attorney has to file a separate charging instrument in addition to the citation. Now, it's not true for traffic. In traffic, the citation is the charging instrument. But there's a provision in here that allows district attorneys to adopt a misdemeanor citation that includes a charging instrument with it, and that's a local option kind of thing, so that they can handle those misdemeanors the same way traffic is handled. Another thing that it does, and it's been a long time sort of issue, is that under current law, what you do is you post bail for these tickets, and then you forfeit bail for these tickets. And what this does is it changes that language to base fine. So essentially what somebody does is they pay a base fine. The court can still call them in egregious situations to go up to the maximum fine set by the legislature. So it gets rid of the bail language. And it adjusts fines so that they fit into the scheme of the A, B, C, and D that is currently established for traffic infractions. And in some instances, it will take a $250 fine and raise it to a $300 fine so it fits into that scheme. So it standardizes the procedure. It standardizes the method for issuing citations, allows district attorneys in some instances to approve the use of misdemeanor citations that don't require a separate charging instrument. It modifies the language in relation to bail so it really stands for a fine, as it pretty much does in reality in current law, and it does some adjustments and fines to fit in with the scheme of the A, B, C, and D that's set up in statutes for infractions, and it changes so that all we would have then would be violations. There would be Class A, B, C, and D violations, and Legislative Counsel's office would be able to standardize that language through the statutes. And then it removes a lot of duplicative language that's in the language in the statutes now about procedures that have been standardized. Some things the bill does not do: it does not change the process by which Multnomah County parking offenses are handled. They're currently handled in the circuit court because in Portland there is no, the municipal court is technically the circuit court, and we didn't change that. Although parking offenses in general are not considered violations that are subject to these processes, local governments handle them on their own in different ways, except Multnomah County. And the reason that it's important to realize that there's that distinction there is because it means between $4 to $8 million for the state, because it takes half of the parking fines for handling them through its court. Another thing that it does not do is increase the general fine amounts that are set out in the structure for, although it adopts the infraction structure for fine amounts with A, B, C, and D, it doesn't increase those amounts generally. And in terms of other amendments, there are a number of them that are up here today that I just found out about today.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
Can you comment on any of those? If you can't, that's fine. We'll bring whoever.
There's one that we specifically asked for, and it was a technical problem with our two. One of them is a set of, I guess, the 20-A25, and those are conflict amendments that David Hendricks proposed. And then I was looking for the next one, and that's the -A19 that we worked with counsel's office on. And that basically allows the base fine amount, which is what the term we're using for bail now, to be substituted or to be rounded to the nearest dollar. Because people get upset if you have their traffic ticket. They get upset enough with their traffic ticket, but if it's $102.50, they get really upset about the 50 cents. So we would round those to the nearest dollar. And those are the two sets of amendments that I know about.
So again, that's 25s and 19s.
25s and 19s. In the Senate, I worked with Dave Hendricks. The committee asked me to work with Dave Hendricks to handle any technical amendments that were going on. And you may have questions. That's a very quick summary of a large bill that is trying to summarize, to standardize what's going on. And I guess I can answer any questions that you've got.
Questions? Mr. Swank. You'll be sticking around for Senate Bill 68.
I'll be sticking around to answer any questions.
If we come up with some as we go along. Thank you very much. I have next Chuck Craig from the Department of Agriculture signed up. Welcome, Mr. Craig.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Chuck Craig, Assistant Director for the Department of Agriculture. And before I begin, could I ask if you all have a letter from Richard Whitman from the Department of Justice dated
May 20? That's in your packets. Is that the May 20 letter?
Right.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, the Department of Agriculture is generally supportive of this bill in concept. We think it's a good idea to standardize the way that a lot of these misdemeanor violations are handled, but we have a couple concerns. First being that we have a number of statutes that range from livestock violations to water quality that have a sort of a misdemeanor offense connected with it, but we also have civil processes that range from license suspensions to civil penalties for the same thing. And we're pretty nervous about the possibility of unilaterally a third party being able to initiate an action in court for one of these violations. And we have had things like that happen before that have caused us some problem, but this extends that possibility to all of our statutes. And we would ask that, because that has the potential to interfere with our discretion to manage our own enforcement programs the way that we think they ought to be done, we would ask that the bill be amended to make it possible for us to exclude certain sections of our statutes from that provision. And Mr. Whitman's letter outlines an amendment that would do that. That is Section 110 of the bill, Section 11 of the bill would allow a third party to commence an action in court, and Mr. Whitman has proposed language for an amendment that would satisfy our concerns. In addition, in Section 110 of the engrossed bill, there's a possibility of a fine and or time in prison for a violation of the statutes in our measurement standards chapter, which include a variety of issues that are not just things like a scale that's not calibrated correctly, but they include offenses such as a person refusing to obey a stop sale order for packaged products that have been improperly weighed or improperly labeled. And there's the possibility there for a really large number of people to be affected by an offense. And we would request that you consider leaving the provision for seeking time in prison in that statute.
And those are the amendments that are covered in Mr. Whitman's?
That's correct, Mr. Chair.
Okay, questions for Mr. Craig? Committee, this again, this bill will be back up later this week on Thursday or Friday, so that'll give us time to get the parties together and any amendments. Mr. Swank, if I could trouble you to come back up for just a second.
I do have a question, if I may.
Oh, you do? Go ahead.
Thank you.
He's coming.
On page 5 of the bill, section 11, I'm a little concerned about third-party people being able to commence the violation. Can you give me what your department's concerns are specifically about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lowe, the concern that we have is that we have civil process as well as the potential of enforcement by in this manner. And we have found over the years that a number of complaints get filed with the department by neighbors to an agricultural operation that really are objecting to some nuisance related to the operation. They didn't thoroughly research the neighborhood when they bought the land next to the dairy, or the dust or the smoke or the spray or something else is a problem. And they find out that they can't do anything about that, that they don't have a right of action because of our right to farm and our land use laws. So over time, it becomes a vendetta, and we have found time and time again people then going into the water quality statutes and the air quality statutes and a variety of things sequentially looking for some kind of a violation to get our agency to do something about this particular agricultural operation. And so that's one aspect of it that we're concerned about. The other is that there's the potential for us to already be taking an action that doesn't satisfy someone. And that has happened also. And so, for instance, we had a case of a dairy where we had fined the operator a substantial amount and required them to sign a consent order that over a period of time would have required the investment of several hundred thousand dollars in their operation to bring it up to compliance with the law, and a group of neighbors who really, I think, mostly didn't want to live next to the dairy initiated some proceedings that had we not found out about it and been able to stop it at the level of the governor's office, it would have initiated a criminal trespass sort of violation there. And I think that sort of thing can easily undermine the credibility of our program with the industry that we're regulating it. And in many cases, the statutes have been vested with us for enforcement because the industry group concern trusts us to carry them out in a fair, impartial, even-handed sort of way. And I think if it becomes possible for anyone to initiate enforcement action, it or the appearance of that, it can pose a problem for us. And we have seen indications of that in the past.
Mm-hmm. Did you? Mr. Swank, I just wanted to ask if you had seen the letter from Mr. Whitman that Mr. Craig was just referring to, if you had any comments on it yet, and if you haven't, well, that's fine. We can wait off.
Chair Shadley, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Brad Swank with the State Court Administrator's Office. I did have a chance to see it. It is interesting. Section 11 is a section that was of some discussion in the work group because there are general statutes now that allow people to initiate both infraction proceedings and violation proceedings on their own, private parties. And there was substantial work done to not expand that. And on the Senate side, we did some clarification. I was just talking to David Hendricks about this back in the back of the room, and he was saying that in terms of the trying to figure out how this applies to the Department of Agriculture. Currently, we could take a look at it and see if there, if we had created something that was not allowed by current law, because that was not the intent of the bill in this section. To the extent that initiating violations by a private party was allowed, that was what we intended to do. But in terms of other misdemeanors, Section 11 doesn't apply to misdemeanors or to other types of civil enforcement actions. It's just a procedure to allow somebody to go into court and get a ticket issued, as they can now in many instances. David mentioned on the Section 110, the amendment to RS 618-991, that may have been an oversight in drafting, and he would go take a look at it. So I can, if the committee would like, I can work it with David and with the Department of Agriculture and see where we can come up to resolve those problems.
Sounds good. Okay. Thank you. David Hendricks, if you could step for a second, just so we can get on the record. The A24 amendments, I think you were recommending those. Technical?
Yeah, I believe those are the conflict confirm. I haven't got a copy. Let me go grab it.
Here. Okay. Those are A25 with conflict.
Yeah, these are conflict amendments that, as you might expect, Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks, Deputy Legislative Counsel, as you might expect with a bill of this size, there are several other bills going through the process relating to violations, infractions. In the A25, for instance, there's one dealing with the double fine provision for traffic safety corridors, and all of which required some adjustment in order to work within the new structure created by Senate Bill 20. So the A25s are intended to deal with some of those other bills that are out there and have already pretty much worked their way through the process and are either on their way to the governor or very close there too.
And the A24s?
This is a small correction that I, when we were looking at the proposed amendments relating to the issuance of citations by officers only occurring within the presence of the officer, I got to looking very closely at ORS 810-410, which is the statute that deals specifically with the authority of officers, police officers, to issue citations for things which they have or have not observed. And it became apparent in looking that we should have done an amendment to 810-425 to delete the reference and to make a reference to Section 9 of the new Act. So this is a technical change that you ought to adopt.
All right, thank you. Anybody else? Thank you, Mr. Hendricks. Thank you, Mr. Swank. Does anybody else wish to testify on the bill today? We have amendments 20, 21, and 22, but I don't see anyone here to testify on those. I think those came, or at least drafted at the request of the chiefs of police. Well, I guess I'll leave it to them if they want to come and talk to us about them.
A reference to
them. Yeah, it was from Dave Hendricks that we have the explanation of them, but I'm not going to ask him to advocate for them one way or the other. Okay, thanks very much. Anybody else on Senate Bill 20 before I close the public hearing? All right.
No.
Oh, what?
I can't help but notice Amendment 18.
Yeah.
That's, cameras.
Yeah,
photo radar. My favorite subject.
We may or may not see that. That'll come back perhaps or perhaps not on Friday. Yes. Okay. Well, I tell you what. Let's reopen the hearing on just as long as we have something going on the record here. I'll explain. The 18s deal with that's photo red light. Photo.
Photo,
that photo red light. Red light, isn't it? Yeah, red light.
Oh, okay. Mounted on street lights.
Yeah, photo red light.
Suitable.
There was some concern as to the fate of that House bill in the Senate, and so these were drafted possibly to amend into this bill on this side, and frankly, I'm leaving it to the proponents to determine, I think, better this week what the fate of the bill is going to be over in the Senate before they bring this back to us. So it's there for a placeholder, but that's all for now.
I wondered what that was all
about.
When are you going to slip past me, Mr. Chair?
Oh, we know nothing will. Okay, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 20. Thank you, Council. And we'll go next to work session on 2633, but again, clarifying for anybody who may have wanted in late, will not be taking action on that today. Rather, I want to get some testimony on the fiscal impact statement, and I asked counties to come in. I think we need to hear from them on this as well. This bill will be back up again on Friday. So let's do that. We'll open a work session on 2633. I don't have our lawyer. Is anybody here from fiscal? Nobody is here from fiscal. Okay. Do you want to come forward, Paul? Committee, just while Paul Snyder is coming forward, I'll point out that you do have the fiscal impact statement. Dr. Higginson, do you want to come up and talk about the fiscal impact, too? I see the health division is referred to in the narrative. You have before you the fiscal impact statement. And the fiscal impact statement addresses the bill in the Dash 8 iteration. And I wanted to get some testimony on that aspect today. And so we have the Mr. Snyder and Dr. Higginson here, too. I guess I'll, I don't know. Dr. Higginson, why don't you go ahead? You were referred to, or at least the agency is referred to, in the fiscal impact statement.
Chair Shedley, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson. I'm the state health officer and deputy administrator for the Oregon Health Division. When I was here a few weeks ago and testified on the bill, we spoke a little bit about fiscal impact. At that time, I said that I thought it would be about $500,000. We were asked after that discussion to go back and reevaluate that. We have done that and still come back with the same fiscal estimate of just a little bit over $500,000. And I'm not sure if fiscal has provided this to you, but one thing that I did provide to legislative fiscal was some of the assumptions that we have used and the information that we have used in coming up with that fiscal impact, and I'd be happy to pass that out if you haven't already received it.
I don't think we've seen your materials. If you would, I'd appreciate that. Just so you know, have you not seen the fiscal impact then? It states the fiscal impact is indeterminate. It does refer to your estimate, but the official comments are that the fiscal impacts of the bill is indeterminate.
Chair Shedley, I have not seen that. I have heard that that was the case, but I have not seen LFO's fiscal impact.
What do we give him? Can we give him a copy of the fiscal impact?
Certainly.
Take a look at that while Mr. Snyder is covering. Yes, Representative Werbelow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While it does say indeterminate, there is also reference to the Oregon Health Division's estimate.
There is, that's right.
Of the $500,000.
Right. Okay, well, he's looking at that. Paul Snyder, do you want to?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. Mr. Chair, with the committee's indulgence, I'd like to just find out first whether I'm reading the bill correctly with the Dash 8 amendments.
Yes, you are.
Oh, good.
Sure. Anybody else want to vote?
I hardly ever do that.
How do you mean?
Well, Mr. Chair, the way I read the bill with the amendments, a person may not terminate a pregnancy except with 48 hours written notice as provided by certified mail. In section, what would then become section 3 with the amendments, it would say, notwithstanding that, attending physician can certify particular circumstances, or the health division authorizes the termination without notice. Then the next session would provide how the health division would provide for that that decision. I'm reading what would now become section 4, beginning with the application, and the whole entire section to be a contested case review. which would mean that the application basically is the beginning of the proceeding. And then from that point, the standard of review is the best interest, well, I read it to say two things, one of which is that termination of the pregnancy without notice is in the best interest of the minor or the ward, as the case might be. Now, if that's the case, it seems to me that it's got three parts, termination of the pregnancy, without notice, and in the best interest of the ward. And if indeed this is a contested case review or a contested case proceeding, then the provisions of what would now become Section 5 would apply to if it's a proceeding before either the health division in one case or a county health department in another case. So if the health division chooses not to do this in one county or 10 counties or 36 counties, then the county health department would have the responsibility for completing this proportion of the bill. And it would do so by a contested case hearing. And so this would be, it would be care providers conducting contested case reviews. Again, if I'm reading this correctly, and that's why I'd like to get confirmation from the committee as to whether or not that's true.
I mean, we may well want to speak with legislative council too before we bring this back on Friday. That's why I wanted to have your comments today on the record.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'll just continue it, assuming sure. that I'm reading it right. That process, the last piece, the best interest of the child or the best interest of the minor or the best interest of the ward, does not include any guidance beyond that as to what is or what isn't in the best interest of that particular individual. And it leaves that judgment to whoever it is that conducts this contested case review. I distributed to the committee testimony from the Oregon Coalition of Local Health Officials. I think they were operating on a presumption. Well, they said two basic points, one of which is that on a policy level, they feel that if notice is going to be given, it should be given by the provider. If I read the bill correctly with the Dash 8 amendments, that's what the bill does. But the other piece is assuming that this direction is chosen, that it should not be a governmental process, but it should be set out by statute what circumstances should apply. In other words, under what situations an abortion should be granted or should not be granted and should not therefore be left to the judgment of a government official, whether at the health division or at the county health department. But they also gave me some other points that I'd like to just share with the committee. And these points indicated to me that they were reading the bill to provide a counseling service rather than a contested case service. I read the bill differently, but regardless, I think these points apply. Their view is that the resources that are currently available in the county health departments to provide this service, most health departments do not provide reproductive health and teen counseling service on a walk-in basis. Appointments are necessary, and sometimes they're 2 or 3 weeks in advance, and given the nature of this particular function, time would probably be of the essence. So changes, significant changes, may have to be made. Family clinics are not scheduled daily so that qualified staff and reproductive health and counseling related to these services are not available every day. To have them available daily would represent a significant increase in professional, i.e. nurses' costs. Staff working in other clinical areas are frequently categorically funded, which means that they can only perform the functions for which they're funded. Usually it's federal funding. And that in these cases, these revenue streams would not apply to this particular function, and so therefore an independent funding source would have to be provided in order for the county to comply with that requirement. The above applies not only to professional staff providing the screening and counseling, but also to interpreters. And if increased demand was placed on family planning clinics, the clinics are so full as it is now, it would necessitate additional clinic hours in most health departments. Now, this does not say that the county health departments would ever do this because it's a judgment call on the part of the health division, Health Division may choose to do it all now and forever. Or they could choose not to do it in a particular case on a particular week or for 2 months in a particular county or for 10 counties or 36 counties. The whole thing is wide open, and it's entirely up to the discretion of the health department whether it does any or all of this. And for how long? It looks to me, the way I read it, that the division can change its mind anytime it wants, in any county it wants. So it seems to be a recipe for a rather difficult situation in order to create any reliability and continuation of responsibility. I expect that under this situation, this would be a ballot measure 30 mandate, and so therefore under that provision, it would have to be funded, or other provisions of that which create exemptions would have to apply. But my view, as I said in reading this, is that rather than providing counseling and health services, this bill seems to envision a contested case process, and I don't think health agencies are set up to do that. I'm sure they're not. They're not set up to do hearings.
All right, questions for Mr. Snyder? Yes, Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Could you just clarify again what you were talking about with the federal money, and you're saying that that money doesn't necessarily follow if we were to pass this into law?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, the example that I was given was WIC, Women and Infant Children funding, for example. Whatever the funding streams are, usually those funds can only be spent for the purposes for which the funds are given. And I think the point here is that many county health departments follow revenue streams that say we've got to do what the funding says we can do and nothing else. And so therefore, if we get a new mandate, we have to find a new funding stream.
Chair Shetterly, can I add to that? Representative Edwards, another issue I think is limitations due to the Hyde Amendment. Whenever we're receiving federal dollars, we are prohibited from addressing abortion referrals. And in fact, last time when I testified here, that was one of the issues that I mentioned, is that the people who are best qualified to be doing this kind of thing in local health departments are probably family planning staff. However, they would be specifically prohibited from federal law to providing such a service as we're talking about here. And then, like Mr. Snyder said, even WIC staff, because that is all federal dollars, would not be able to do this either, although that would be inappropriate for them to be doing that in the first place.
Yes.
So do you have a list of, beyond those two, I mean, the WIC, are there others that would be affected by this, by the Hyde Amendment? I mean, who specifically? I guess I'd forgotten about the Hyde Amendment. So are there, I guess it, to me, brings the question, how does this work? Unless you have outside money to fund it.
Right, Chair Shetterly, Representative Edwards, our budget, for instance, is only 10% state general fund, and the majority of it, I believe about 60 to 70%, is federal fund. We then pass a lot of those dollars through to local health departments, so they're receiving substantial federal funds as well, but then they supplement that with county funds and some state general funds as well. So it's a real mix of funding streams that they're getting there, but there are a lot of federal dollars at both the county level and the state level that we'd have to be concerned about with the Hyde Amendment.
Last
sure, thing. Yes.
You also raised, Mr. Snyder, an interesting problem as well, which is the weekends. One might want to come in on a Friday or come in over the weekend. I mean, obviously that becomes a little troublesome under this scenario.
Okay.
Unlike a physician who more than likely has their services available 24 hours, so I guess I'd never even thought about that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edwards, that could be a problem. Mr. Chair, if I may,
sure, yes, yes,
one
yes.
more piece that I forgot to mention. If it is a contested case process that's envisioned by the bill, I'm having some difficulty trying to understand who would be the other party. But the whole question is whether or not this should happen without informing the parents. So by its nature, the parents don't know about it. And it would be begun by the application of the minor or the ward, whoever that might be, and it could include the minor or ward's attorney and witnesses. But I just don't know who would be on the other side of the case to argue the other side.
Well, it's interesting you raise that, and we'll want to take a look at that. I think if you look at the original bill on page 2, line 7, and I see that that has been deleted by the dash 8 amendments, but there it does provide the procedure for review of an order denying an application shall be as provided in Chapter 183, which is getting at your contested case proceedings. That would contemplate, I think, that the application process itself would not be conducted as a contested case proceeding, but that in the event of an order denying the bypass, basically, that at least as contemplated in the original bill, review of that order would be conducted by the division then as a contested case proceeding. Does that, just on that discrete issue, does that work better as far as you envision the counties? That is, the contested case proceeding then would not occur at the county level, but would be conducted by the division according to those, according to, as an APA Chapter 183 proceeding.
Well, it would be a little bit less problematic, Mr. Chair. The issues that we have and the reasons why at this point we're opposing the DAS 8 amendments, I haven't stated that because I wasn't quite sure I was reading it right, are because, first of all, in its current form, it would constitute an unfunded mandate. And secondly, because our view is that local control should prevail, and so for that reason, the county health department should not be required to take on this responsibility.
Thank you. Dr. Higginson, you look like you want to chime in there.
Yeah. No, do you want me to, Chair Shedley, do you want me to respond to the legislative fiscal?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. And in fact, while you're doing it, our fiscal officer. Okay. Okay. Go ahead.
Actually, just a couple of things. And one is Mr. Snyder raised some issues about who was going to be doing this and our delegative responsibilities. And actually, I have a question, too, because on the fiscal impact under ballot measure 30, it says this bill has no anticipated fiscal effects on local governments or districts. And then if I read the dash 8 amendments on page 2, line 12, B, if the division does not maintain an office in the county, the division shall designate a public officer in the county to accept applications under this section. And as we discussed the last time, the division does not have offices in counties. We have one state office building in Multnomah County, but the rest we don't. So basically, the way I read this is that we would be required to designate a county officer to be the one who is conducting these reviews. And then, however, later on line 17, it says the division may delegate its responsibilities under this section to a local public health authority, and that the local public health authority may not decline to accept the responsibilities. And so I guess I'm a little confused still about what our responsibility is the idea that we would decide when to delegate, and then counties, once designated, could not decline, or are we to make this a local system and virtually delegate to every county? And fiscal impact-wise, I don't think it makes a lot of difference. The way that we have developed our fiscal impact analysis, we looked at it as having one person at the state who would be doing evaluations in the Tri-County Valley area and then contracting with services outside. But I think that the level of service would mean that the cost would be about the same whether or not it was a local-based system or a state-coordinated system.
Mr. Olson? Why don't you come on forward? You've been hearing the testimony. Mr. Olson is the fiscal officer, and if I could ask you just to respond maybe to some of the comments or questions that have been raised.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Rick Olson, Legislative Fiscal Office. I'm sorry I had to step out for a few minutes and make a phone call down to my office, so I'm not sure I heard all the questions, but I will be glad to address the fiscal impact. We did receive the fiscal information from the Health Division. We did review that thoroughly. We did some independent research. We think many parts of the information that the Health Division's provided you and us is valid. But we think the $500,000 is probably on the high end, and that some of the items that they outlined in their fiscal impact statement could be absorbed within the current budget and current resources that they have within the division. For example, they have in their fiscal impact information a research analyst at halftime. We're not sure that there's going to be that much data to track to keep a halftime person busy. We think there's staff there that could probably do part of that. The bottom line to our fiscal impact statement is we don't know. We don't know how many of these individuals are going to come and request this bypass procedure that's outlined in the bill. We've done some research and found that when bills like this are enacted, a couple things can happen. One is these teens who are seeking an abortion can go to a neighboring state that don't have parental notification. So the 343 that the Health Division has estimated, we think is high. We don't think all 343 of those will seek this bypass procedure. But again, we have no way of knowing exactly how many it would end up being.
Dr. Higginson.
Well, Chair Shedley and members, in regard to that number of 343, I agree with Legislative Fiscal there. I mean, we don't know how many of those teenagers are going to go to a neighboring state or elsewhere to have the abortion done. However, we came up with a number. We cannot assume that anyone is going to, and that's why we used the full 343 when we were doing our fiscal impact. And in response to the issue that this is something that we can absorb within existing resources, you know, we are faced with this all the time. We're in the process right now of going through our budget and are going to be receiving cuts in a number of what we think are substantial areas, and to say that we can absorb more cuts is very difficult for us to hear.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Higginson, where does the 343 come from?
343, and this is dealt with in the materials that I passed out, is that there's just over 1,000 abortions to teenagers, the 15, 16, 17-year-olds at the current time. And in looking at the research that we saw, one thing that we looked at was a national study that showed that 61% of teens reported one or both parents were notified prior to an abortion. So we thought that the high end, 39% would be asking for a bypass. And then we looked at the experience in Minnesota, and estimated there that about 32% of the teens were actually asking for a bypass where one of their parents did not know. And so we used a figure of 33%, which was somewhat in the middle between those two figures and coming up with the 343. And I am the first to admit to you, Representative Witt, that this is not the best science. I mean, a lot of this we just don't know. We are not going to know until we have some experience.
Representative Backlund.
Thank you, Chair. Dr. Higginson, I notice that you're basing your statistics on a study in 1992 and another one in 1990. These are the most recent that you could find?
Chair Shedderly, Representative Backlund, I believe that they are. I asked staff to find the latest and the best information that we could gather, and this is what we have.
Okay. Well, we'll have to have some discussions. I think I'll close this today unless there's anybody else who wishes to testify specifically on the fiscal impact statement. If we have any other questions, if not, sure we'll have some conversations after this. This will be back before us on Friday. Give us a chance to iron some of these things out, perhaps working together now that we've got a better understanding of what the issues are between the county, the agency, and the fiscal impact. Okay, thank you very much. Close the work session then on House Bill 2633. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 68. Counsel.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senate Bill 68 would allow a city that has located in it a justice court and the small claims division of a circuit court to combine those into one entity, as long, if there's an intergovernmental agreement which would describe the procedures for referring cases to that small claims court. As you see in the staff measure summary, there is at least one county in the state in which the small claims court and justice court occupy the same building, a doorway away from each other. So that is what the bill does, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Mr. Swank, welcome back.
Chair Shetterly, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. I'm with the State Court Administrator's Office. If it were earlier in session, I would probably describe this as a simple bill, but you probably hadn't gotten tired of simple bills.
We've got ourselves wrapped up around a plenty of those.
Yeah. Let me explain. Senate Bill 68 actually started out as something else and was amended in the Senate to put this provision in because we had a judge who had a problem. Actually, we have a judge and a justice in the peace in Baker City. And what happened was that a few years ago, the circuit court and district court in the state of Oregon were merged. And there was a requirement in statute that district courts have a small claims division. Now, there were some counties that didn't have district courts. All they had was a circuit court. And in most of these counties, there was a justice court that was allowed to sit in the same city, and there were eight of them. And when they were merged, what happened was that there was a requirement created that the circuit court have a small claims division, and there is also a requirement that a justice court have a small claims division. We have one county, one city, Baker City, where this created an issue because you have Judge Milo Pope, who's the circuit judge for the 8th Judicial District, who holds court across the hall from Justice of the Peace, Larry Cole. Judge Pope has never had to have a small claims division before because he was a circuit court and he didn't have a district court. Judge Cole, on the other hand, has gotten very much into small claims, has an extensive small claims division with mediation and arbitration and a lot of those kinds of processes, and they felt that it would not be economical to have two small claims divisions across the hall from each other in Baker City. So they called me and said, can you solve this problem? Hence the bill. The bill allows them to enter into an intergovernmental agreement so that only one of them has to provide a small services through a small claims division. As I said, there are seven other rural counties where the justice court, normally justice courts are prohibited from sitting in the same city as the circuit court. There were eight rural counties where they were grandfathered in to allow the justice courts to continue in the same city. We've checked with those courts. This isn't a particular issue with them. When we mentioned the bill to them, they said, oh, that's interesting, but I'm not sure it's a problem here. So as far as I know, the only court that it affects is the only two courts that it affects are both in Baker City. And there were no dissenting votes in the Senate other than the possibility of avoiding the costs of establishing a small claims division in Baker City. There's no fiscal impact on this, and we recommend it for your favorable consideration. I can answer any questions you've got.
Okay, does anybody have any questions for Mr. Swank?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Not for Mr. Swank, but are we going to move into work session?
I'm happy to move into work session on this one.
Good.
Get one out today anyway.
Makes sense.
Yeah. Okay, let's do that. Then we'll close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 68.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Werbelow.
I move Senate Bill. There's no amendments.
No. Well, actually, it comes to us as an Ann Gross.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I recommend Senate Bill 68, Ann Gross, to the floor with a due process recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Werbelow moves Senate Bill 68A engrossed to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, please call the roll.
Representative Backman?
Aye.
Representative Edwards?
Excused.
Representative Lowe? Representative Werbelow?
Yes.
Representative Walker?
Yes.
Representative Wells?
Yes.
Representative Williams?
Yes.
Representative Witt?
Yes.
Yes, Senate Bill 68A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Do we have a volunteer to carry it? Representative Lowe has it. Thank you. Then we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 68. That concludes our business for the day. Committee, just for committee business, you've been distributed today a copy of the Tanner decision. This, in case you have not read it yet, this will be your primer for tomorrow. We'll begin with an overview of the Tanner case from Mr. Schuman.
Will there be a test on
that? No, there will not be. Yeah, there will. That's right, down the road. I did hear the speaker's announcement today that we would be meeting on the floor tomorrow from 1:30 until 3:30. I'm going to check with her this afternoon what that means for tomorrow's committee meeting, whether we'll be excused or what, because I know I assume we have folks coming from out of the area to testify.
You wanted them tomorrow, didn't you, Mr.
Yes, Chairman? I did. We had scheduled this, and today's announcement was the first I had heard about an afternoon session tomorrow. So I will see if we can get ourselves excused so we can do this, because we do have folks coming in from out of town, I know, for tomorrow's hearing, and I don't want to inconvenience them. So stay tuned on that. We'll get to your offices if there's a schedule change. Otherwise, assume that we will meet tomorrow. And with that, we are adjourned.
Mr. Chair.